This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR. Here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Hey, thanks for being with us on a Labor Day weekend. We appreciate you spending some time with us. We have a packed show today. We have three guests. We're going to talk crime and punishment, and we'll get to our first guest right now.
Our first guest is Mona Lynch. She is a professor at the University of California, Irvine, and she has just published a most provocative book entitled Sunbelt Justice, Arizona and the Transformation of American Punishment. Welcome to the Think Tank.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I don't want to eat up your time. There is a core thesis to your book, and I wonder if you would start up by telling us what that is.
The thesis of the book is that Arizona, in a lot of ways, accounts for a number of changing practices in the late 20th century, was really an innovator in changing punishment practices in a way that led to mass incarceration. So mass incarceration is the kind of very quick rise over the 70s and 80s and 90s of incarceration in states around the country. And Arizona was really a leader in doing that. It started a little earlier than other states, and it innovated a number of both legislative changes and punitive practices behind bars that were became sort of trendsetters around the country. So that's what the book was looking at, and then it pulled it apart by looking at Arizona's history to see how that state got there and why it was able, and it, particularly in a state like Arizona where there's a real sort of ethos of fiscal frugality, how it could spend so much on prisons and change their behavior so quickly and so dramatically in the late 20th century.
Oh, a word like dramatically is a little vague for me. Can you give us some quantitative sense as to what order of magnitude you're talking about? What kind of incarceration rates, and how do we compare to other states?
Okay, so Arizona was at or below the national average, bouncing around 100 people locked up for every 100,000 of population up until the mid-1970s, and then it just started shooting up, and it sort of hit a plateau in the late 90s, early 2000s, and has been well above 500. So we're talking about 5 to 6 times higher over a relatively short period of time, where the 100 per 100,000 rate was really a steady state for decades upon decades around the country and in Arizona. So this was a dramatic sort of uprising, and now we're stuck in Arizona at rates of about 583 per 100,000. And that is among the top 10 in the nation. It's actually sixth in 2011. In 2012, it was sixth in the nation for high incarceration rates, sitting mainly with states from the South, not the Western peers, not Nevada, not California, but Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, and Oklahoma are the higher ones than Arizona.
Now, what about are you familiar with the national figures that compare our country as a whole to other comparable countries throughout the world? How are our incarceration rates compare?
We are an international leader. So not only did we change our own sort of internal norms around how many people we locked up over a relatively short period of time, we went from becoming sort of a moderately low incarceration nation to really the highest among our peer nations and among the top few among all nations in the world. So we're a worldwide leader. And so when you talk to people from around the world and you're discussing the concept of mass incarceration, that's pretty much tied to the American way of punishment.
So Mona, real quick though, Mona, when you say incarceration, are we talking long-term incarceration? Are we talking getting locked up for the weekend? What do you mean when you say incarceration?
That's a really good question. That's an important distinction because the numbers get much higher if you include those shorter-term people. So when I'm talking about the incarceration rates and the numbers I'm using, I'm talking about strictly people who have been sentenced to prison. And prison is in almost every jurisdiction defined as a period of longer than a year or longer. So you don't go to you go to state prison. It's real hard time. You know, it's the pen, as they say, and that may be up to life. So
okay. prison, you've established that incarceration rates are higher. What happened to bring this about, and what's your analysis of how this happened, and what has been the consequence?
The way it came about, and I'll just use Arizona as an example since we're talking in Arizona and because I've done the most research on that, there are a lot of shifts in politics in the late 1960s and early 1970s that made crime a much more salient kind of political weapon to use to, sort of drum people up and get support and so on. And there certainly was a lot of crime and fear of crime that was kind of corollary to that. And at the same time, there was a whole movement that was questioning whether prisons were working as rehabilitative institutions. So there are these twin things happening where there's, rhetoric around crime and fear of crime in the public and political spheres, and then there's this questioning of prisons as the response. And one could have seen the road going a different way, and we would have developed all new ways to deal with crime if prisons are failing to do what they're supposed to do and crime is rising and, becoming more scary, we would think we could have invented new things. But what happened was prisons became very seen politically and in the public eye as a very different institution almost overnight. So rehabilitation sort of went out the door. Prisons became places for incapacitation. So, lock them up and throw away the key. Who cares what happens behind bars? Just take the people off the street and throw them in there. So we had the rise because it could, this very easy kinds of slogans like three strikes, you're out, and so on, were able to sort of generate some political support for it. And prison building started happening. People were getting elected. Legislatures were, spending money either through bond measures or in Arizona early on, they tried to pay up front for this to build more prisons and send more people to prisons. Then code changes happened. So Arizona had a major penal code change in 1978 that really is responsible for bringing many, many more people into prison than had ever been in the state. So the numbers just jumped dramatically after that law change.
All right, and that's Mona Lynch, author of Sunbelt Justice, Arizona in the Transformation of American Punishment. We continue next with two very special guests, Bill Montgomery, Maricopa County Attorney, and Justice of the Peace, Cecil Ash, when we return to the think tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We're back here on The Think Tank, and we are discussing the seminal topic of crime and punishment. Our first segment was an interview with Mona Lynch, a professor of criminal justice. And during the break, she wanted me to bring out a point, and I'll do this by way of introduction, just to quantify the impact of increasing prison population. She pointed out that the Arizona state budget went from 4% devoted to corrections up to 11% currently, so almost tripling the relative budget, and of course in hard dollar terms even more. One of the other things that was a premise in her book, and we had a preliminary discussion yesterday, and I asked if mandatory sentencing was contributing to in a major way to incarcerations. And she said that her response to that was that the most important person in the entire system that determines correction policy is the county attorney. Her point was that it is the county attorney that decides what to charge, whether to invoke crimes that trigger mandatory minimums, for example. By way of introduction, Bill Montgomery is that person in Maricopa County. His office makes the decisions about who to charge and what to charge. And welcome to the show. And
thank you.
I want to give you an opportunity to react to what you've heard. And kind of my reaction to that is either Americans or Arizonans in particular, perhaps, way more violent, way less law-abiding than any other people on earth, or else our system's out of whack. But it I suspect you may tell me I'm wrong. Tell me.
You're wrong.
That was concise.
There we go. Next topic. Well, actually, the people who make the decisions about what kind of crimes can be charged and what kind of time they're going to serve are actually the criminals. Because I don't go out and recruit people to commit crimes. They're the ones who are responsible for the conduct in the first place. And if we don't have the evidence in order to charge the crimes, then we can't conduct a prosecution. So it's a bit facetious to try to say that it's all on the backs of prosecutors. But relatedly, we do have the responsibility on behalf of the community and the particular victim of a crime to hold criminals accountable. The laws that we have on the books represent a very reasoned policy approach to try to address those who are responsible for the most crime committed or the greatest harm committed to individuals in our community, incarcerate those, while at the same time seeking diversion programs and offering substance abuse treatment to those individuals who may be able to be rehabilitated or have not yet shown that they're committed to a life of crime that would necessitate incapacitation. And let me illustrate. From the more recent study that was done of our prison population, where we actually looked at the demographics, over 95% of the people incarcerated are there for a violent offense or for having committed repetitive felonies.
I'm sorry, that was 95%?
Yeah, the actual number is 95.1. You can see this at azsentencing.org. It carries the over 300-page report that was done on Arizona's prison population. With the less than 5% who are in there for so-called nonviolent crimes, I mean, that includes people who've been convicted of child molestation or drug trafficking, who actually make up more than half of that population. In fact, it's about 63%. So, you know, I would challenge anyone to look at that population and say, okay, who do you want to let out? Prosecutors are doing a darn good job in Arizona of making a good distinction between those who would be eligible for a diversion program and those who should be going to prison, evidenced by that demographic. In terms of diversion and substance abuse treatment, I would also say that we're doing a good job there. In fact, the session before this last one, prosecutors went to the state legislature and asked to have our diversion statute amended so that prosecutors were not in a position of being unable to offer a diversion program to a second-time drug possession offender who, by Arizona law, is going to get substance abuse treatment simply because they'd already been convicted one time of a drug possession offense. We wanted to be able to offer a diversion program a second time to incentivize those who have substance abuse problems so that they wouldn't wind up in a situation where they could go to prison. After that point in time, if they continue to commit drug possession offenses, odds are really good they're going to move on to commit property crimes and victimize our community. So, and when you look at our prison population now, we've been averaging a net outflow. The amount that had previously been estimated for capital outlays for the Department of Corrections was around $1 billion. They don't need that anymore. Instead, what they're asking for are capital outlays to transition bed space from minimum or medium security to maximum security, reflecting that change in the violent nature of the prison population. That's what's really going on.
So if I understand you, what you're saying that the overall prison population is going down, but the proportion who are in there for are more serious offenses are going up?
Correct. So we're sending more of the correct people who should be there. And we're seeing less technical violations for probation or community supervision, and we're not sending the drug offenders there. The other important point to make, too, is that a dollar spent on public safety is a dollar that was spent for a constitutional duty by the state. So if the state winds up spending money less in other areas where they really don't have a constitutional duty, but they are spending dollars in areas where they have an utmost duty to protect the public, that's a good expenditure of dollars.
Okay. Our other guest here is Cecil Ash. You are a justice of the peace. You're a former legislator. But the real reason I invited you here was I have a brain trust of smart people that I call on for advice about who to bring in. And description of you that I got from this brain trust source was this is probably the, and I quote, probably the most knowledgeable person in the state about good corrections public policy.
Thank you, Mike. I'm sure that wasn't said by a prosecutor.
It was, and it wasn't, and you, it wasn't your wife either. I saw you quoted in the paper the other day, and you made a very provocative statement. You said 20% of the people in prison should never be let out, 20% shouldn't ever be there, and the rest, well, it depends on what we do with them.
That's correct.
I wonder if you'd react to what the county attorney has said, and give us your take from your experience.
Well, yeah, I do have some reaction to what Mr. Montgomery said. I in the first place, I don't think we can lay the blame on the county attorneys. They're doing their job, and most of them do a good job. The responsibility lies with the legislature. And over the last 4 years, they've refused to look at any idea of sentencing reform. I tried to establish a sentencing advisory committee. In fact, Mona Lynch appeared in front of our committee to tell us about the history of crime in Arizona and incarceration. So it's not the county attorney's job to set the sentencing. It's the legislature's job that sets the mandatory sentencing laws. The second thing Bill said is prosecutors are deciding who goes to prison by the way they charge, and it shouldn't be the prosecutors. That's the prerogative of the judges. The judges should be the impartial triers of the case who hear the facts, both the pro and con for any defendant, and they should decide ultimately who goes to prison.
But if I understand it, I mean, you don't get in front of a judge until a prosecutor has charged you with something. So inherently, a prosecutor has to make a discretionary decision about what the charge is.
Well, they do, and that's the problem. The prosecutors actually are deciding who goes to prison. There was a judge up in Prescott recently that said, I would like to sentence you to a defendant, 70-year-old man. He said, I'd like to sentence you to probation. That's what I would like to do based on the facts that I've heard. Instead, he had to sentence the man to a mandatory 90 years in prison, and his hands were tied. And so that's what the legislature has done. It's not, the county attorney prosecutes it, but the legislature ties the hands of the judges in so many cases. And what we are having a net outflow in our prisons now, but I attribute that to the Safe Community Act, which is one of the few changes that's been enacted to the mandatory prison statutes, involving people on probation that are being sent back to prison. As a result of that Safe Communities Act, we've reduced the number going back to prison by 27%. So I just want to see judges have more discretion. I think we needed a sentencing advisory committee, which was a bill I ran that was opposed by the prosecutors. And we need more of a overview of citizens' overview of the Department of Corrections.
We are talking crime and punishment with, as usual, the experts. We have Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery with us, Justice of the Peace Cecil Ash as well. More to come right after a break. Thanks for being with us, folks. This is The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
The subject matter is crime and punishment. Our guest are Professor Mona Lynch, County Attorney Bill Montgomery, and Justices of the Peace and former legislator Cecil Ash. The subject a minute ago was judicial discretion, and I want to address this question to the county attorney because the impression that I've had of our revised criminal code that was rewritten in the late 70s is that there are a lot of frustrated judges that who hear cases and once many charges are bring, once somebody's convicted, their hands are very much tied. Am I wrong about that? And how much discretion, in your mind, should a judge have in the area of sentencing?
Well, they've got enough now. Back in the 70s, the code was rewritten because prior to that, we had what was referred to as indeterminate sentencing. In other words, you could commit a home burglary and get anything from probation to 30 years in prison. And what we found was that that was incredibly discriminatory. If you were in a rural county, you could get probation, but if you were in, or correction, if you were in an urban county and you're a minority and committed an offense like that, you could get probation. But if you were in a rural county, they were being sentenced to prison. So the determinate sentencing structure, which is what we've got right now, made it more fair and more equal that if you're going to commit a similar crime as someone else under similar circumstances with a similar criminal history, you're going to face a similar sentencing range. And so, you know, the people speaking through their legislature wanted to have more of that. And you cannot forget that over the same period of time, Arizona's crime rates have fallen at a rate faster than the United States. And if you disconnect the policy results from the policy tools implemented, you're not going to have a full and fair conversation on this.
I think you have to look at what other states are doing. The state of Washington has a population slightly larger than Arizona's. It has a prison population of 16,000, whereas we have 40,000 roughly in our prisons. Now, it has gone down, and I think the reason the prison population's gone down. It's because of the Safe Community Act and a few other things that we've tried to do. But basically, we still incarcerate far too many people in Arizona. And judges' hands are tied. I've been told that numerous times, that they would like to do something different, but the legislature and the county attorney, by the way they've charged something, have tied their hands.
How is immigration playing into this? Obviously, we're here. We're ground zero of immigration. Here we are. How is our immigration population factor into this? Because you used Oregon, I believe. It's how those are a little different.
Yeah,
I'll say Washington, correct.
And you cited it incorrectly.
There's roughly 6,000 or less illegal immigrants in our prison system the last time I looked. And so even if you take them out, that's still roughly 34,000 people.
Okay. Most of the immigrant, they often go to federal court for the illegal reentry, and then often for corollary crimes like drug trafficking, they often end up in federal court as well. So that's why their numbers are down in the state.
Not necessarily. The numbers are down in Arizona because we have less of an illegal alien population than we used to. Over the last several years, that population has dropped from anywhere from 200 to 300,000. Plus, and I'll give the federal government kudos on this, the increased resources on the border has cut down on some of the impact in our community from crime associated with both human and drug smuggling. But to correct the point on Washington, when Cecil first made that point back in 2011, they had 18,000 prisoners. And if you factored in everybody who was being supervised in an incarceration situation, including federal incarceration, those numbers are different. In fact, at that point, Washington has over 160,000 and Arizona has just over 140,000. So it's not apples to apples. And the fact that we have a different criminal environment in Arizona is something that is not always factored in when you're looking at other states.
Are you saying for some reason in the state of Washington that people are more likely to end up in federal court?
That's what those numbers actually show. Mm-hmm. So if you want to just use raw numbers for state prison populations, it's not going to work out. You've got to look at the entire population that's being supervised in corrections if you want to try to make that kind of a one-to-one mm-hmm. comparison.
The problem I have with the prosecutors in the state, and I don't mean to disparage them, there are many good people doing their job, but we tried to have a sentencing advisory committee advise the legislature, and the prosecutors opposed this. And the legislature is composed of 90 people, and very few of them have any kind of criminal justice experience in the system, unless they get charged with something, and then they sing a different tune. But the problem is nobody really looks at it from a impartial, objective view to see why there's a variance between the different states. Texas started a program several years ago by Representative Jerry Madden to reduce their prison population. They implemented a number of new programs, and our state should look at what other states are doing. And I have a problem with the prosecutors opposing those kinds of moves because they approach it from, frankly, a rather biased point of view as prosecutors.
Yeah, and that's incredibly unfair. What Texas did was follow our lead. Texas looked at diversion programs. They looked at increasing the threshold for the value of property for theft. They're doing what we had already done. And you know, the reason why there wasn't a sentencing commission is because the reasons given and the justifications for it by Mr. Asher in that time and all the anecdotes he kept providing were false. My folks spent an incredible amount of time having to run down every false anecdote that he provided, whether it was what happened to somebody who had been sentenced. I doubt that the facts are true with respect to the Prescott judge who wanted to give probation instead of to give 90 years. I'd want to know. Okay, well, you said Prescott. I'd want to know exactly what that case was, because you would continually mislead people about what had happened in a case and what the true facts were and what had happened to a victim.
Well,
and
Bill,
you're doing
if
it again now, and I'm not going
to
let you get away.
If you wanted to know the source of the anecdotes, what they were, you should have sent somebody to ask me. I could provide them names.
Cecil, we did. Every single
nobody
time.
Nobody ever asked
every
me.
Single, look, I got a stack of stuff right here.
Can you show me any correspondence
yep.
that you sent me?
I sure can. And we'll do it later, but it won't help you now.
I wrote Bill two-page letter.
Can I just add a point in here about the sentencing reform? There has been widespread outside examinations of the sentencing code and how it operates in Arizona since the early 90s when it was first recognized as a problem in terms of just sending too many people and sometimes the wrong people to prison. And every time these reports have come back to the code and suggested it doesn't give enough flexibility to the whole work group to come up with a sentence. It gives too much to the charging decision, which is, of course, in the prosecutor's hands. And there has been, throughout the process of trying to do sentence reform, there have been prosecutors' groups that have been opposed to even thinking about changing the code, so not even having that conversation. And I think that to that end, and I was at the one of the hearings in 2010 that was put on by the legislature, and it happened there as well, that's a conversation that has to happen. Coming in opposed to it and not being willing to think about the ways that that code can be changed, I think, is a problem, because Arizona is just going to continue to be, it's not really dropping the way other states are dropping. It's pretty flat in terms of its overall incarceration.
But the problem is that you don't define the problem in a way that accurately reflects the facts. You want to come in and argue for reform first. And what people wind up trying to use to justify the need for reform is comparing to other states who, in fact, are simply implementing reforms that Arizona has already engaged in. So when you continue to make the effort to reform, the question I ask is reform what and why? Our public policy, particularly in criminal justice, is working. Our prison population has been declining. Our crime rate has been declining. The number of violent and percentage of violent felons in prison has been increasing. That's called success.
Well, you still incarcerate far too many people in comparison to other jurisdictions. And all we were asking for was a committee to objectively look at what is taking place in other states. Arizona is lagging way behind. Texas has done reforms. Missouri has done reforms. North Carolina has done reforms. Even New York City has done reforms. And if we have somebody who's objective about this and not the prosecutors look at it, I think we might find some answers to the prison overpopulation.
I want to ask you both as a concluding comment. I mean, everybody wants the same. We want our communities to be safe. If somebody is dangerous and a threat to other people, we want them off the streets.
Yes.
How do we know how much is enough?
That's a great question.
It is a good question. Right now, we're incarcerating people that we're mad at. We need to incarcerate only those that we have reason to fear for our safety, and we're putting people away that are no threat to public safety or who could be otherwise sentenced or punished without the expensive alternative of incarceration, which is significantly high. It's something like $25,000 a year.
Just a couple seconds here, Bill, if you can go ahead.
Sure. And what I would say, too, is you've got to look at the nature of the criminal environment we're facing and whether or not the people we are sending to prison are the people who should be there. You can say that, you know, is 40,000 people too many? Well, objectively, sure. All right. Now let's look at those 40,000 and see who we can let out. Find them. You tell me which of those 40,000 you think should be back in our communities and whether or not you would want that person living next door to you.
Dr. Mike O'Neill and I will wrap it all up when we come back. Thanks for being with us, folks. This is The Think Tank, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
And we want to thank Mona Lynch, the author of Sunbelt Justice, Arizona and the Transformation of American Punishment, our in-studio guest, Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery, and Justice of the Peace and former legislator Cecil Ash. That got a little testy. Apparently, we don't have a consensus on incarceration here in the great state of Arizona. And, of course, always with me is Dr. Mike O'Neill of O'NeillResearch.com. You can get marketing and public opinion research. Also, you can get podcasts of any Think Tank episode at MikeO'Neill.org. Doc, what were your initial thoughts?
First of all, my head is spinning. we clearly don't have consensus on this issue, and I have multiple facts that I really don't. I'm not sure that I can resolve. One is we've quadrupled our incarceration rates. Mm-hmm. That's undisputed, and the question is, are we any safer? And I don't know. I mean, I think the county attorney made an interesting point at the end. He said, you know, let me show you the people that are in there now. Who do you want to let out?
Yeah.
And
pick. Look at your line item, right?
Well, But and I don't know the answer to that. You know, are there embedded in those folks a whole lot that are not a risk to anybody? The county attorney seems to think not. Cecil Ash clearly thinks yes. And I'm a data analyst. I'm looking for more data. I don't know the answer to that.
Sure.
You know, so and that is to me the crux of the essence of all of this. Look, we all want to be safe. That is this is Maslow building block number one. We want to be secure and safe in our homes and property. That is the number one function of government. That's not arguable.
Okay.
On the other hand, as we start increasing incarceration, 25,000, you know, you take some bad guy and you put him away for 40 years. You just sentenced me to $1 million in taxes, me, Mr. Taxpayer here, to pay for that guy. Now, depending on who that is and what they look like, that may be a good investment.
Right.
But it's a very expensive investment, especially as we're talking about longer and longer periods of time. So, you know, I don't know the answer to this.
Now, I guess we have to establish a baseline. And you know all about those, Doc. So we have to establish a baseline. What is prison for? What's the goal of incarceration? Is your goal to is it to deter crime? Is it to rehabilitate those that commit crimes? Or is it to lock them up and keep them away from polite society? Which one is it?
All of the above. Historically, it has been all of those. I think what has happened over the last 30 years is we've lost faith in the ability of prisons to rehabilitate. And I think almost anybody in the system will tell you right now.
I would agree.
Our current prisons do not they punish, for sure.
Okay, punishment, one check.
They may deter other people, depending on a whole lot of things.
Okay,
you know?
Right.
And that, you know, you send out the message, if you do this, you're going away for prison. And not only are those people incapacitated, but other people who don't want to go to prison may say, that's not something that I want. That assumes that that audience is rational. If you're drug addicted or something like that,
you're not thinking about prison.
You're not thinking beyond the next fix. Mm-hmm. So
sure.
It probably doesn't do it. But however, if they get you and they incapacitate you, that does it. I think most people are pretty much agreed now. If the goal is rehabilitation, prison is not the place to do it. There are alternatives, and they work imperfectly. They work imperfectly because it's a very tough population. Most people who are going to prison are screwed up in some fashion.
Right. You know? We've seen the ills of mandatory sentencing. We've seen some bad marks there. We've seen some good. I think that Mr. Ash was looking for more lenience, more wiggle room, really, for judges in sentencing, where it seemed that Mr. Montgomery was, let's stick by the book.
I think they've engaged in a war by anecdote, and one side says, look at this case, and this judge let this guy off with a slap on the wrist for something that was horrific.
We were talking off air. Yeah. We were talking about Billings, Montana, right. The judge that let the rapist go right. With a 30-day sentence.
And on the flip side is, again, war by anecdote. Somebody who gets, three strikes and a third felony, but it happened to be cashing a check for $101 and, you know, whatever. And you use that anecdote and we say, do we really want to put that person away for 30 years at a cost of almost $1 million? And most people would say, no, that's not a good use. We don't. The other thing, and we didn't have time to get to this, but it seems to me as a society, even on the pure punishment side, we have been pretty uncreative. I mean, there's ways to punish people.
Ooh, I like creative punishment. You're right.
There's ways to punish people without other and means other than, for example, what always gets treated as a slap on the wrist, community service, 100. Well, 100 hours, yeah, that may be. What about 1,000? What about 10,000? 10,000, that's the equivalent of 5 full years of work.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's pretty serious stuff.
Yes.
You know? Or other kinds of things other than putting somebody in a box that can be punitive because that punishment is indeed one of the goals. And can they be sufficiently punitive to deter and to fulfill societal needs for retribution because you did something real bad, you ought to pay a serious price, while at the same time not sending somebody to an advanced degree in crime school and having them come out worse than they come in, because 90% of these guys who go into prison are coming back out to live with us.
Here's something that I wanted to get into that we didn't touch on, the private prisons.
Yeah.
it seems to me like the more prisoners they have, the more money they make.
That it absolutely is a concern. I thought about that, and I thought it would divert us off into a kind of a cul-de-sac.
Those two might have gotten in a fist fight. You know, we talk about private prisons.
There's a concern about it. By the way, that's not a complete – it's not only public-private, because you can look at some states, and prison unions are pretty powerful political devices. And they have
California, we're seeing this right now with Jerry
California
Brown.
Prison Union, it has political power. If you look at the contributions to the Arizona State Legislature by various private prison organization, you're going to see a lot of names you know there. So in other words, that problem doesn't go away, whether it's public or private. Either way, there's money to be made, and it's difficult to disentangle that from the politics.
Right, and when I was addressing Governor Jerry Brown in California, they've been mandated to release a certain amount of prisons. Their cure was, let's just build more private prisons, and we'll do so with the prison unions.
Yep. And that's in effect what we've done here too. You know, I guarantee you build a prison, you're going to fill it. So the question is, how many of these do you want to have? And what do they also? I think, what do they look like? You know, you build a zoo, you get animals. You know, what are the physical structure? What is going on inside of these walls? And again, I don't think we need concern ourselves about the 10 or some odd percent who are going to be there for the rest of their lives. But the other 90% who are coming out, I just assume they came out better than when they went in.
Okay, but then we also mentioned the rehabilitation is it's really a non-starter. It's not there. It's non-existent.
Well, I think some of the outside prison programs are having put it this way, very, very tough. We're dealing with people who are messed up, who have all kinds of problems. And those aren't easy fixes.
Is Sheriff Joe helping or hurting? I didn't want to ask them. I don't think
I
either of them would have answered.
I don't know. I think to personalize it is that
what we see as what we envision as the MCSO and their immigration sweeps and the like and the 10 cities and things like that, that their crackdown on DUIs and the like.
I think those are separate issues.
Really?
You know, and I think the DUI punishment, that's where the punishment model is clearly most in evidence. You say, you get a DUI, you're going to jail for a year. That really, I think, is separate from the prison population. These are more hardcore folks who are, for the most part, committing felonies or very serious misdemeanors. And I think that's as opposed to the drunk driver, which is more or less a random microcosm of people out there. I wouldn't want to politicize. I think the state level stuff. It's a different kind of animal.
And I think I speak for a lot of people out there that would ask that question. They don't know those are separate. They don't know there's a lower level crime and a felony kind of crime.
If you go, Sheriff Joe, a year and a day, you're going to prison. Less than a year, you might go to county jail. It's a completely different operation.
Right. Now, you talk about the inside, what it's like on the inside. You talk about the physical structures of these prisons. We talk about building more and the like. Don't you think, and this is what I believe, that part of the human condition just comes out. You could make it a Taj Mahal, but the prisoners are going to get together. There's going to be a hierarchy. There's going to be a pack mentality. We'd call it a gang mentality in prison. There's the human condition will come out. You can't legislate or punish your way out of that.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the downside. And the sad part is that isn't really what we sentence people to. We sentence them to be locked away by the state under conditions controlled by the states. But a lot of these prisons are, in effect, end up being controlled by the prisoners just because of sheer numbers.
The governor comes to you tomorrow and gives you a pen. So you fix it. How do you fix it?
Oh, and you have the you asked me this question with the go-away music. God, you know what? I'd like a third-party study of some of this kind of stuff.
Okay.
I don't come away with a real quick, glib 15-second, this is what you do to fix it.
All right. I'm sorry to back you in that corner. Thanks for being with us. Happy Labor Day weekend, everybody. This is The Think Tank on News Talk 92.3 KTAR.